Part III, Epistemology since Kant. All propounders of theories of knowledge since Kant have been influenced to a greater or lesser degree by the mistaken way he formulated the problem of knowledge. As a result of his, in quotes, a prioriism, he advanced the view that all objects given to us are our representations, in italics. Ever since, this view has been made the basic principle and starting point of practically all epistemological systems. The only thing we can establish as an immediate certainty is the principle that we are aware of our representations. This principle has become an almost universally accepted belief of philosophers. As early as 1792, G. E. Schultz maintained in his Anesidemus, that all our knowledge consists of mere representations, and that we can never go beyond our representations. Schopenhauer, with a characteristic philosophical fervor, puts forward the view that the enduring achievement of Kantian philosophy is the principle that the world is, quote, my representation, unquote. Edward von Hartmann finds this principle so irrefutable that in his book Kritische Grundlegung des Transzendentalen Realismus, Critical Basis of Transcendental Realism, he assumes that his readers, by critical reflection, have overcome the naive identification of the perceptual picture with the thing in itself, that they have convinced themselves of the absolute diversity of the subjective ideal content of consciousness, given as perceptual object through the act of representing, and the thing existing by itself, that these are different, in other words, independent both of the act of representing and of the form of consciousness. In other words, readers who have entirely convinced themselves that the totality of what is given us directly consists of our representations. Let me read that again. Sorry for the editorializing there. Read that sentence again. Edward von Hartmann finds this principle that the world is my representation so irrefutable that in his book, Critical Basis of Transcendental Realism, he assumes that his readers, by critical reflection, have overcome the naive identification of the perceptual picture with the thing in itself. That they have convinced themselves of the absolute diversity of the subjective ideal content of consciousness, given as perceptual object through the act of representing, and the thing by itself, independent both of the act of representing and of the form of consciousness. In other words, readers who have entirely convinced themselves that the totality of what is given us directly consists of our representations. In his final work on epistemology, Edwin von Hartmann did attempt to provide a foundation for this view. The validity of this in relation to a theory of knowledge free from presuppositions will be discussed later. Otto Liebmann claims that the principle, quote, consciousness cannot jump beyond itself, unquote, must be the inviolable and foremost principle of any science of knowledge. Foucault is of the opinion that the first and most immediate truth is, quote, all our knowledge extends to begin with only as far as our representations, unquote. He called this the most positive principle of knowledge and considered the theory of knowledge to be eminently critical only if it, quote, considers this principle as the sole stable point from which to begin all philosophizing, and from then on thinks it through consistently, unquote. Other philosophers make other assertions the center of epistemology. For example, the essential problem is the question of the relation between thinking and existence, as well as the possibility of mediation between them. Or again, how does that which exists become conscious, Remke, etc.? Kirchmann starts from two epistemological axioms, quote, the perceived is, unquote, and quote, the contradictory is not, unquote. According to E. L. Fisher, knowledge consists in the recognition of something factual and real. He lays down this dogma without proof, as does Goering, who maintains something similar. Quote, knowledge always means recognizing something that exists. This is a fact that neither skepticism nor Kantian criticism can deny. Unquote. The two latter philosophers simply lay down the law. This, they say, is knowledge, without judging themselves. Even if these different assertions were correct, or led to a correct formulation of the problem, the place to discuss them is definitely not at the beginning of a theory of knowledge, for they all represent at the outset a quite specific insight into the sphere of knowledge. To say that my knowledge extends to begin with only as far as my representations is to express a quite definite judgment about cognition. In this sentence, I add a predicate to the world given to me, namely, its existence in the form of representation. But how do I know, prior to all knowledge, that the things given to me are representations? Thus this principle ought not to be placed at the foundation of a theory of knowledge. That this is true is most easily appreciated by tracing the line of thought that leads up to it. This principle has become in effect a part of the whole modern scientific consciousness. The considerations which have led to it are to be found systematically and comprehensively summarized in part one of Edward von Hartmann's book, Das Grundproblem der Erkenntnistheorie, The Fundamental Problem of Epistemology. What is advanced there can thus serve as a kind of guide when discussing the reasons that led to the above assumption. These reasons are physical, psychophysical, physiological, as well as philosophical. The physicist who observes phenomena that occur in our environment when, for instance, we perceive a sound, is led to conclude that these phenomena have not the slightest resemblance to what we directly perceive as sound. Out there, in the space surrounding us, nothing is to be found except vibrations of material bodies and of air. It is concluded from this that what we ordinarily call sound or tone is simply a subjective reaction of our organism to those wave-like movements. Likewise, it is found that light, color, and heat are something purely subjective. The phenomena of color diffraction, refraction, interference, and polarization show that these sensations correspond to certain transverse vibrations in external space, which, so it is thought, must be ascribed partly to material bodies, partly to an infinitely fine elastic substance, the ether. Furthermore, because of certain physical phenomena, the physicist finds himself compelled to abandon the belief in the continuity of objects in space, and to analyze them into systems of minute particles, molecules, atoms, the size of which, in relation to the distance between them, is immeasurably small. Thus he concludes that material bodies affect one another across empty space, so that in reality force is exerted from a distance. The physicist believes he is justified in assuming that a material body does not affect our senses of touch and warmth by direct contact, because there must be a certain distance, even if very small, between the body and the place where it touches the skin. From this he concludes further that what we sense as the hardness or warmth of a body, for example, is only the reaction of the peripheral nerves of our senses of touch and warmth to the molecular forces of bodies which act upon them across empty space. These considerations of the physicist are amplified by those of the psychophysicist in the form of a science of specific sense energies. J. Mueller has shown that each sense can be affected only in a characteristic manner, which is conditioned by its structure, so that it always reacts in the same way to any external stimulus. If the optic nerve is stimulated, there is a sensation of light, whether the stimulus is in the form of pressure, electric current, or light. On the other hand, the same external phenomenon produces quite different sensations according to which sense organ transmits it. This leads to the conclusion that there is only one kind of phenomenon in the external world, namely motion, and that the many aspects of the world which we perceive derive essentially from the reaction of our senses to this phenomenon. According to this view, we do not perceive the external world itself, but merely the subjective sensations which it releases in us. Thus, physiology is added to physics. Physics deals with the phenomena occurring outside our organism to which our perceptions correspond. Physiology aims to investigate the processes that occur in man's body when he experiences a certain sense impression. It shows that the epidermis is completely insensitive to external stimuli. In order to reach the nerves connected with our sense of touch on the periphery of the body, an external vibration must first be transmitted through the epidermis. In the case of hearing and vision, the external motion is further modified through a number of organs in these sense tools before it reaches the corresponding nerve. These effects produced in the organs at the periphery of the body now have to be conducted through the nerve to the central organ, where sensations are finally produced through purely mechanical processes in the brain. It is obvious that the stimulus which acts on the sense organ is so changed through these modifications that there can be no similarity between what first affected the sense organs and the sensations that finally arise in consciousness. The result of these considerations is summed up by Hartmann in the following words, quote, "The content of consciousness consists fundamentally of the sensations which are the soul's reflex response to processes of movement in the uppermost part of the brain, and these have not the slightest resemblance to the molecular movements which called them into being." End quote. If this line of thought is correct and is pursued to its conclusion, it must then be admitted that our consciousness does not contain the slightest element of what could be called external existence. To the physical and physiological arguments against so-called, quote, naive realism, unquote, Hartmann adds further objections which he describes as essentially philosophical. A logical examination of the first two objections reveals that in fact one can arrive at the above result only by first assuming the existence and interrelations of external things as ordinary naive consciousness does, and then investigating how this external world enters our consciousness by means of our organism. We have seen that between receiving a sense impression and becoming conscious of a sensation, every trace of such an external world is lost, and all that remains in consciousness are our representations. We must therefore assume that our picture of the external world is built up by the soul using the material of sensations. First of all, a spatial picture is constructed using the sensations produced by sight and touch, and sensations arising from the other senses are then added. When we are compelled to think of a certain complex of sensations as connected, we are led to the concept of matter, which we consider to be the carrier of sensations. If we notice that some sensations associated with a substance disappear while others arise, we ascribe this to a change regulated by the causal laws in the world of phenomena. According to this view, our whole world picture is composed of subjective sensations arranged by our own soul activity. Hartmann says, quote, "Thus all that the subject perceives are modifications of its own soul condition, and nothing else." Unquote. Let us examine how this conviction is arrived at. The argument may be summarized as follows. If an external world exists, then we do not perceive it as such, but through our organism transform it into a world of representations. When followed out consistently, this is a self-canceling assumption. In any case, can this argument be used to establish any conviction at all? Are we justified in regarding our given world picture as a subjective content of representations just because we arrive inevitably at this conclusion if we start from the assumption made by naive consciousness? After all, the aim was just to prove this assumption invalid. It should then be possible for an assertion to be wrong and yet lead to a correct result. This can happen, but the result cannot then be said to have been proved by the assertion. The view which accepts the reality of our directly given picture of the world as certain and beyond doubt is usually called naive realism. The opposite view, which regards this world picture as merely the content of our consciousness, is called transcendental idealism. Thus, the preceding discussion could also be summarized as follows. Transcendental idealism demonstrates its truth by using the same premises as the naive realism which it aims to refute. Transcendental idealism is justified if naive realism is proved incorrect. But its incorrectness is only demonstrated by means of the incorrect view itself. Once this is realized, there is no alternative but to abandon this path and to attempt to arrive at another view of the world. Does this mean proceeding by trial and error until we happen to hit on the right one? That is Hartmann's approach when he believes his epistemological standpoint established on the grounds that his view explains the phenomena, whereas others do not. According to him, the various worldviews are engaged in a sort of struggle for existence, in which the fittest is ultimately accepted as a victor. But the inconsistency of this procedure is immediately apparent, for there might well be other hypotheses which would explain the phenomena equally satisfactorily. For this reason, we prefer to adhere to the above argument for the refuting of naive realism and investigate precisely where its weakness lies. After all, naive realism is the viewpoint from which we all start. It is therefore the proper starting point for a critical investigation. By recognizing its shortcomings, we shall be led to the right path much more surely than by simply trusting to luck. The subjectivism outlined above is based on the use of thinking for elaborating certain facts. This presupposes that, starting from certain facts, a correct conclusion can be obtained through logical thinking, parenthesis, logical combination of particular observations, parenthesis. But the justification for using thinking in this way is not examined by this philosophical approach. This is its weakness. While naive realism begins by assuming that the content of experience, as we perceive it, is an objective reality without examining if this is so, the standpoint just characterized sets out from the equally uncritical conviction that thinking can be used to arrive at scientifically valid conclusions. In contrast to naive realism, this view could be called naive rationalism. To justify this term, a brief comment on the concept of naive is necessary here. A. Döring tries to define this concept in his essay Über den Begriff des naiven Realismus, concerning the concept of naive realism. He says, quote, "The concept naive designates the zero point in the scale of reflection about one's own relation to what one is doing. A naive content may well be correct, for although it is unreflecting and therefore simply non-critical or uncritical, this lack of reflection and criticism excludes the objective assurance of truth and includes the possibility and danger of error, yet by no means necessitates them. One can be equally naive in one's life of feeling and will as in the life of representing and thinking in the widest sense. Furthermore, one may express this inner life in a naive manner, rather than repressing and modifying it through consideration and reflection. To be naive means not to be influenced, or at least not consciously influenced, by tradition, education, or rules. It means to be, in all spheres of life, what the root of the word nativus implies, that is unconscious, impulsive, instinctive, daimonic." End quote. Starting from this, we will endeavor to define naive still more precisely. In all our activities, two things must be taken into account: the activity itself and our knowledge of its laws. We may be completely absorbed in the activity without worrying about its laws. The artist is in this position when he does not reflect about the laws according to which he creates, but applies them using feeling and sensitivity. We may call him naive, It is possible, however, to observe oneself and inquire into the laws inherent in one's own activity, thus abandoning the naive consciousness just described, through knowing exactly the scope of and justification for what one does. This I shall call critical. I believe this definition comes nearest to the meaning of this concept, as it has been used in philosophy, with greater or lesser clarity, ever since Kant. Critical reflection, then, is the opposite of the naive approach. A critical attitude is one that comes to grips with the laws of its own activity in order to discover their reliability and limits. Epistemology can only be a critical science, for its subject is an essentially subjective activity of man, cognition, and it wishes to demonstrate the laws inherent in cognition. Thus everything naive must be excluded from this science. Its strength must lie in doing precisely what many thinkers, inclined more toward the practical doing of things, pride themselves that they have never done, namely, quote, think about thinking. The end of section III. Part IV, or part IV, the starting point of epistemology. As we have seen in the preceding chapters, an epistemological investigation must begin by rejecting existing knowledge. Knowledge is something brought into existence by man, something that has arisen through his activity. If a theory of knowledge is really to explain the whole sphere of knowledge, then it must start from something still quite untouched by the activity of thinking. And what is more, from something which lends to this activity its first impulse. This starting point must lie outside the act of cognition. It must not itself be knowledge, but it must be sought immediately prior to cognition, so that the very next step man takes beyond it is the activity of cognition. This absolute starting point must be determined in such a way that it admits nothing already derived from cognition. Only our directly given world picture can offer such a starting point. That is, that picture of the world which presents itself to man before he has subjected it to the processes of knowledge in any way, before he has asserted or decided anything at all about it by means of thinking. This, quote, directly given, unquote, picture is what flits past us, disconnected, but still undifferentiated. Footnote, differentiation of the given, indistinct world picture into distinct entities is already an act of thought activity. End of footnote. In it, nothing appears distinguished from, related to, or determined by anything else. At this stage, so to speak, no object or event is yet more important or significant than any other. The most rudimentary organ of an animal, which in the light of further knowledge may turn out to be quite unimportant for its development in life, appears before us with the same claims for our attention as the noblest and most essential part of the organism. Before our conceptual activity begins, the world picture contains neither substance, quality, nor cause and effect. Distinctions between matter and spirit, body and soul, do not yet exist. Furthermore, any other predicate must also be excluded from the world picture at this stage. The picture can be considered neither as reality nor as appearance, neither subjective nor objective, neither as chance nor as necessity. Whether it is thing in itself or mere representation cannot be decided at this stage. For as we have seen, knowledge of physics and physiology, which leads to a classification of the quote-unquote given under one or the other of the above headings, cannot be a basis for a theory of knowledge. If a being with a fully developed human intelligence were suddenly created out of nothing, and then confronted the world, the first impression made on his senses and his thinking would be something like what I have just characterized as the directly given world picture. In practice, man never encounters this world picture in this form at any time in his life. He never experiences a division between a purely passive awareness of the directly given, in quotes, and a thinking recognition of it. This fact could lead to doubt about my description of the starting point for a theory of knowledge. Hartmann says, for example, quote, "We are not concerned with the hypothetical content of consciousness in a child, which is just becoming conscious, or in an animal at the lowest level of life, since the philosophizing human being has no experience of this. If he tries to reconstruct the content of consciousness of beings on primitive biogenetic or ontogenetic levels, he must base his conclusions on the way he experiences his own consciousness. Our first task, therefore, is to establish the content of man's consciousness when he begins philosophical reflection." Unquote. The objection to this, however, is that the world picture with which we begin philosophical reflection already contains predicates mediated through cognition. These cannot be accepted uncritically, but must be carefully removed from the world picture so that it can be considered free of anything introduced through the process of knowledge. This division between the given, in quotes, and the known, in quotes, will not, in fact, coincide with any stage of human development. The boundary must be drawn artificially. But this can be done at every level of development, so long as we draw the dividing line correctly between what confronts us free of all conceptual definitions and what cognition subsequently makes of it. It might be objected here that I have already made use of a number of conceptual definitions in order to extract from the world picture as it appears when completed by man that other world picture which I described as the directly given. However, what we have extracted by means of thought does not characterize the directly given world picture, nor define, nor express anything about it. What it does is to guide our attention to the dividing line, where the starting point for cognition is to be found. The question of truth or error, correctness or incorrectness, does not enter into this statement, which is concerned with the moment preceding the point where a theory of knowledge begins. It serves merely to guide us deliberately to this starting point. No one proceeding to consider epistemological questions could possibly be said to be standing at the starting point of cognition, for he already possesses a certain amount of knowledge. To remove from this all that has been contributed by cognition, and to establish a pre-cognitive starting point, can only be done conceptually. But such concepts are not of value as knowledge. They have the purely negative function of removing from sight all that belongs to knowledge, and of leading us to the point where knowledge begins. These considerations act as signposts, pointing to where the act of cognition first appears, but at this stage do not themselves form part of the act of cognition. Whatever the epistemologist proposes in order to establish his starting point raises, to begin with, no question of truth or error, but only of its suitability for this task. From the starting point, too, all error is excluded, for error can only begin with cognition, and therefore cannot arise before cognition sets in. Only a theory of knowledge that starts from considerations of this kind can claim to observe this last principle. For if the starting point is some object or subject to which is attached any conceptual definition, then the possibility of error is already present in the starting point, namely in the definition itself. Justification of the definition will then depend upon the laws inherent in the act of cognition. But these laws can be discovered only in the course of the epistemological investigations itself. Error is wholly excluded only by saying, "I eliminate from my world picture all conceptual definitions arrived at through cognition, and retain only what enters my field of observation without any activity on my part. When, on principle, I refrain from making any statement, I cannot make a mistake." error in relation to knowledge that is epistemologically can occur only within the act of cognition. Sense deceptions are not errors. That the moon upon rising appears larger than it does at its zenith is not an error, but a fact governed by the laws of nature. A mistake in knowledge would occur only if, in using thinking to combine the given perceptions, we misinterpreted larger and smaller. But this interpretation is part of the act of cognition. To understand cognition exactly in all its details, its origin and starting point must first be grasped. It is clear, furthermore, that what precedes this primary starting point must not be included in an explanation of cognition, but must be presupposed. Investigation of the essence of what is here presupposed is the task of the various branches of scientific knowledge. The present aim, however, is not to acquire specific knowledge of this or that element, but to investigate cognition itself. Until we have understood the act of knowledge, we cannot judge the significance of statements about the content of the world arrived at through the act of cognition. This is why the directly given is not defined, as long as the relation of such a definition to what is defined is not known. Even the concept, quote-unquote, directly given, includes no statement about what precedes cognition. Its only purpose is to point to this given, to turn our attention to it. At the starting point of a theory of knowledge, the concept is only the first initial relation between cognition and world content. This description even allows for the possibility that the total world content would turn out to be only a figment of our own eye, capital, which would mean that extreme subjectivism would be true. Subjectivism is not something that exists as given. It can only be a conclusion drawn from considerations based on cognition. That is, it would have to be confirmed by the theory of knowledge. It could not be assumed as its basis. This directly given world content includes everything that enters our experience in the widest sense. Sensations, perceptions, opinions, feelings, deeds, pictures of dreams and imaginations, representations, concepts, and ideas. Illusions and hallucinations, too, at this stage, are equal to the rest of the world content, for their relation to other perceptions can be revealed only through observation based on cognition. When epistemology starts from the assumption that all the elements just mentioned constitute the content of our consciousness, the following question immediately arises. How is it possible for us to go beyond our consciousness and recognize actual existence? Where can the leap be made from our subjective experiences to what lies beyond them? When such an assumption is not made, the situation is different. Both consciousness and the representation of the I are, to begin with, only parts of the directly given, and the relationship of the directly given to the two former must be discovered by means of cognition. Cognition is not to be defined in terms of consciousness, but vice versa. Both consciousness and the relation between subject and object in terms of cognition. Since the, in quotes, given is left without predicate, to begin with, the question arises as to how it is defined at all. How can any start be made with cognition? How does one part of the world picture come to be designated as perception and the other as concept? One thing as existence, another as appearance, this as cause and that as effect. How is it that we can separate ourselves from what is objective and regard ourselves as I, in contrast to the not I? We must find the bridge from the world picture as given to that other world picture which we build up by means of cognition. Here, however, we meet with the following difficulty. As long as we merely stare passively at the given, we shall never find a point of attack where we can gain a foothold and from where we can then proceed with cognition. Somewhere in the given, we must find a place where we can set to work, where something exists which is akin to cognition. If everything were really only given, we could do no more than merely stare into the external world and stare indifferently into the inner world of our individuality. We would at most be able to describe things as something external to us. We should never be able to understand them. Our concepts would have a purely external relation to that to which they referred. They would not be inwardly related to it. For real cognition depends on finding a sphere somewhere in the given where our cognizing activity does not merely presuppose something given, but finds itself active in the very essence of the given. In other words, precisely through strict adherence to the given as merely given, it must become apparent that not everything is given. Insistence on the given alone must lead to the discovery of something which goes beyond the given. The reason for so insisting is not to establish some arbitrary starting point for a theory of knowledge, but to discover the true one. In this sense, the given also includes what, according to its very nature, is not given. Let me read that sentence again. In this sense, the given also includes what, according to its very nature, is not given. The latter, not given, would appear, to begin with, as formally a part of the given, but on closer scrutiny would reveal its true nature of its own accord. The whole difficulty in understanding cognition comes from the fact that we ourselves do not create the content of the world. If we did this, cognition would not exist at all. I can only ask questions about something which is given to me, something which I create myself, I also determine myself, so that I do not need to ask for an explanation for it. This is the second step in our theory of knowledge. It consists in the postulate. In the sphere of the given, there must be something in relation to which our activity does not hover in emptiness, but where the content of the world itself enters this activity. The starting point for our theory of knowledge was placed so that it completely precedes the cognizing activity, and thus cannot prejudice cognition and obscure it. In the same way, the next step has been defined so that there can be no question of either error or incorrectness. For this step does not prejudge any issue, but merely shows what conditions are necessary if knowledge is to arise at all. It is essential to remember that it is we ourselves who postulate what characteristic feature that part of the world content must possess with which our activity of cognition can make a start. This, in fact, is the only thing we can do. For the world content as given is completely undefined. No part of it, of its own accord, can provide the occasion for setting it up as the starting point for bringing order into chaos. The activity of cognition must therefore issue a decree and declare what characteristics this starting point must manifest. Such a decree in no way infringes on the quality of the given. It does not introduce any arbitrary assertion into the science of epistemology. In fact, it asserts nothing, but claims only that if knowledge is to be made explainable, then we must look for some part of the given which can provide a starting point for cognition, as described above. If this exists, cognition can be explained, but not otherwise. Thus, while the given provides the general starting point for our theory of knowledge, it must now be narrowed down to some particular point of the given. Let us now take a closer look at this demand. Where, within the world picture, do we find something that is not merely given, but only given insofar as it is being produced in the actual act of cognition. It is essential to realize that the activity of producing something in the act of cognition must present itself to us as something also directly given. It must not be necessary to draw conclusions before recognizing it. This at once indicates that sense impressions do not meet our requirements, for we cannot know directly, but only indirectly, that sense impressions do not occur without activity on our part. This we discover only by considering physical and physiological factors. But we do know absolutely directly that concepts and ideas appear only in the act of cognition, and through this enter the sphere of the directly given. In this respect, concepts and ideas do not deceive anyone. An hallucination may appear as something externally given, but one would never take one's own concepts to be something given without one's own thinking activity. A lunatic regards things and relations as real, to which are applied the predicate reality, although in fact they are not real. But he would never say that his concepts and ideas entered the sphere of the given without his own activity. It is a characteristic feature of all the rest of our world picture that it must be given if we are to experience it. The only case in which the opposite occurs is that of concepts and ideas. These we must produce if we are to experience them. Concepts and ideas alone are given us in a form that could be called intellectual seeing. Kant and the later philosophers who follow in his steps completely deny this ability to man, because it is said that all thinking refers only to objects and does not itself produce anything. In intellectual seeing, the content must be contained within the thought form itself. But is this not precisely the case with pure concepts and ideas? Parenthesis, by concept, I mean a principle according to which the disconnected elements of perception become joined into a unity. Causality, for example, is a concept. An idea is a concept with a greater content. Organism, considered quite abstractly, is an idea. Parenthesis. However, they must be considered in the form which they possess, while still quite free of any empirical content. If, for example, the pure idea of causality is to be grasped, then one must not choose a particular instance of causality or the sum total of all causality. It is essential to take hold of the pure concept, causality. Cause and effect must be sought in the world. But before we can discover it in the world, we ourselves must first produce causality as a thought form. If one clings to the Kantian assertion that of themselves concepts are empty, it would be impossible to use concepts to determine anything about the given world. Suppose two elements of the world content were given, A and B. If I am to find a relation between them, I must do so with the help of a principle which has a definite content. I can only produce this principle myself in the act of cognition. I cannot derive it from the objects, for the definition of the objects is only to be obtained by means of the principle. Thus a principle by means of which we define objects belongs entirely to the conceptual sphere alone. Before proceeding further, a possible objection must be considered. It might appear that this discussion is unconsciously introducing the representation of the I, capital, of the quote-unquote personal subject, and using it without first justifying it. For example, in statements like, quote, we produce concepts, unquote, or, quote, we insist on this or that, unquote. But, in fact, my explanation contains nothing which implies that such statements are more than turns of phrase. As shown earlier, the fact that the act of cognition depends upon and proceeds from an I can be established only through considerations which themselves make use of cognition. Thus, to begin with, the discussion must be limited to the act of cognition alone, without considering the cognizing subject. All that has been established thus far is the fact that something given exists, and that somewhere in this given the above-described postulate arises, and lastly, that this postulate corresponds to the sphere of concepts and ideas. This is not to deny that its source is the I, capital, but these two initial steps in the theory of knowledge must first be defined in their pure form. The end of section 4, and the end of this section. I will begin the third part of this with part 5, cognition and reality.